I have the perfect guests joining me today. Mike Leonard is in the 1 o'clock hour. Mike, you're perfect because you're great at what you do. But you
go on, John.
You talk a lot too.
Yeah.
Which, as many of our listeners know, I've just been dealing with a strained voice little bit. It has some power here today. We'll see how it goes for the Hawks game tonight, but I appreciate having a talker with me.
Well, I've been practicing, so I'm going to do both roles. So how's this? Hey, John Hatson here, WGN Radio 720. We got Mike Leonard today, and then I answer the question. You think people will buy that?
You gave me a real Harry Carey spin there a little bit.
That's my, in my house, that's my radio voice, John.
I like it. But no, you've got a great natural radio voice, and Mike Leonard, if you're just new to this program, a federal defense attorney, state's defense attorney too, defense attorney, and you also help out whistleblowers, and you've been working on a bunch of interesting cases, I'm sure. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about if you could just kind of set up where we are with the Ed Burke trial. It's been a very strange trial so far because I feel like we've had stops and starts.
Yeah, they seem to be heading into the home stretch. So the problem was, number one, jury selection took an incredible amount of time. And, you know, the fear there was that with Burke's notoriety, with all the press attention to it, they really needed to dig deep to figure out, you know, if jurors had biases.
I just want to remind people, Ed Burke, former alderman. I know a lot of people know this, but I just want to set it up again. Former alderman for years and years, longest serving Chicago alderman of all time. Basically a corruption scandal that there was bribery or hints of bribery from a franchisee of a Burger King, basically being encouraged, allegedly, to employ his law firm on the side to essentially, that's how you get the gig, right? That's how you be able to build this here.
Yeah, so Burke, obviously, long-serving alderman from, I think, about 1970 or so. I'm sure I'm probably off. Someone can correct me. But also, chairman of the city finance committee. So
yeah,
real powerful position. But the allegations are kind of set out in sort of what they're kind of billing as chapters, right? So you alluded to one of them, which is the Burger King episode, where a guy from Texas who owns about 150 Burger Kings across the country had some in Chicago. And the allegations are that Burke was using his office to pressure this guy not to give him money directly, but to hire his law firm. That's the allegation.
Okay, that's and chapter
so,
one.
Yeah, so that's, I'm not sure if that was presented as chapter one or not, but that seems like the one that's getting the most attention in the press, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of the order of witnesses, he had some testimony about it and some days of testimony, then you came back to it. And then another thing that, apart from the jury selection that's made it go long, is you had attorneys who got COVID. And so their participation was in a different manner. Some had to participate by video means, and there were some days off because of that. But what seems to be exciting is that next week the defense is going to call as a witness former Alderman Danny Solis, who is kind of the ultimate mole right now in Chicago. Like he's on tapes with Madigan. He's going to be
a lot of people.
He's going to be a centerpiece of that trial. He's the centerpiece of this trial, even though, interestingly enough, the government didn't call him as a witness. So they played tapes with Solis, and they were clearly intentionally trying to keep him off the stand, right? Because they know he would be brutally attacked for and impeached on many different levels. But now in the defense case, they're going to put him on. And it's fair game because he's the one who's on all these tapes. And clearly the defense is going to try to attack it by, you know, it's not necessarily the same as entrapment, but that's basically what they're going to say that he was doing.
Let me recap this. So Danny Solis, the former alderperson who was recorded on, who volunteered to be recorded on tapes, correct?
Correct. The government had him, so to speak, on, you know, some violations of law, some probably significant potential criminal offenses, right? And he did what some people choose to do in those situations. He said, okay, I'll become a cooperator, meaning I will essentially continue to work in my job, and it was for a period of a couple of years. And he was secretly tape recording people, including Madigan, people close to Madigan, and other officials, including Burke. And so now he's at the forefront of this case.
He's one of the pillars of the case.
Yeah, without even being called as witness. But
I was going to say.
But he's on the tapes, right? And so, you know, my perception, I'm not familiar with all the chapters, but, you know, the Burger King chapter, I think, in many ways seems to have a lot of flaws from a prosecutorial standpoint, you know.
Are you just saying that because you're a defense attorney?
No, I think it is. I think that of the chapters that I'm aware of, it seems like a weaker one, you know, where no business was actually given to Burke's firm. there was a lot of muddled evidence, I thought, about the whole operation.
Could be argued it's politics.
Yeah, of course.
Standard stuff.
Politics that, you know, sometimes aldermen get involved in those issues. But to me, I have not been impressed with the strength of the government's case. And I know they don't have to prove, let's be clear, they don't have to prove there was this direct quid pro quo where Burke's office actually got the business. Certainly that would make the case stronger. But I think it's a flawed case, but we'll see what the jury has to say about that.
Is it unusual for the prosecutors not to bring up not to call as a witness one of the main pillars of their case? And then is it also strange then for the defense to do it instead?
Well, the defense really had no choice, right? Because you got the guy who's on the tapes,
you want to poke holes in it.
Yeah, he's also the architect and has the communications with the law enforcement about the tapes, the setup for the tapes, you know, the purpose of the tapes. So, you know, you're kind of going with the route that, you know, Solis really is attempting for his own benefit to say certain things in a certain way to make the case for the government stronger in a very intentional fashion. So since the government won't call him and has no obligation to, the defense has the option to call him, and they're going to, which it'll make for huge press. It'll be fun to hear about that, and it'll be fun to see the cross-examination. Really, he's being called as a witness by the defense, but he's really what's called an adverse or hostile witness, right? So he should be able to be examined in a cross-examination style. I expect he'll be on the stand for at least a day, maybe more than that. You know, so it should be some good fireworks.
You mentioned that the feds likely had stuff on Solis, and that's why he cooperated. Is his immunity or his promise to not be charged with X, Y, or Z in the future, is it contingent on, obviously not the verdict, but is it contingent on how well the, you know, the cross-examination goes or the witness stuff, or not usually?
No, not at all. Not at all. But there's this sort of fiction that operates in the federal system and also in the state system where you put a cooperator on the stand and you get this testimony from them. Hey, you know, yeah, I agreed to cooperate. Yeah, you know, it's gonna give me a benefit, but there's no guarantees here, right? And who's going to decide what benefit you get? Oh, the judge is going to decide. So this sort of fiction that he's an objective, nonpartisan person is ridiculous, right? And that's going to certainly come out during his testimony because he's getting a huge benefit, and he only did it because of that benefit.
It's weird to have a case that stops and starts. That must be frustrating for the lawyers and everyone, really.
Well, I think it's got to be the toughest part is for the jurors. Okay, so first of all, they, you know, you're called to be a potential juror. So you go down to the Dirksen building. You may be, even if you're someone who's still in the pool and is not excluded yet, you're still waiting around for days. They finally get a jury impaneled after a week or two. And then you have the COVID stop and start. And then it's a long trial. You have two defendants also, you know, one of Burke's sort of sidekicks, I think his name's Peter Andrews, is also a co-defendant and is a key part of the case. But then when you have the stop and starts with the attorneys, when you have a case that's this long anyways, it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult, number one, to pay attention all that time, and you're hearing somewhat repetitive evidence at times. It's not all sexy, right? You know, the Tribune story is just giving you some highlights, but if you actually sit through a day of trial in any case, you'll see there's a lot of parts that are boring. You know, the prosecution has a burden to get into evidence various things, and they have to call a lot of witnesses just for those purposes, right? And then you add the layer of having tape recordings, which are lengthy. So it's a very difficult job for the jurors. And the practical thing is, can you really remember well what happened in week two when you're at week six?
No.
And then the thing that's really difficult in these cases, and the jury instructions in this case are purportedly going to be 200 to 300 pages long.
Whoa.
Which in my mind is just ridiculous.
A lot of instructions.
Yeah, you know, and the crazy thing is the judge has to read them out loud to the jury, right, as if they can really, you know, really take that in at the time.
When I build something, I can't do more than 2 or 3 pages of instructions.
Yeah, it's not realistic. And then they get a copy of them, of course, for the jury room. But, you know, part of that time is spent just figuring out, okay, we heard the judge read for 2 hours. Now, how do we really do this? Let's go to the counts. Let's go to the elements of the counts. It's a tough job.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's leave the Ed Burke trial behind. I'm sure we'll touch on that in the coming weeks. I wanted to ask you a question that I've often been wondering about plea deals. I know you've been a part of many of them over the years. And, you know, we've often even seen, you know, cases that we think are not going to be pled out you know, the jury is pooled and everything. And then all of a sudden there's this drama. We saw this in the Fulton County case involving the conspirators, co-conspirators, alleged co-conspirators to the Trump case. And then everyone gets there and there's a plea deal. Who usually approaches who first in those, or does it depend on the circumstances?
It's an ongoing discussion. So really in any case, particularly in a federal case, you know, even early on, you may request and get what's called a draft plea agreement, which is the government's position about, hey, here's what we're willing to do. But in federal court, it's oftentimes really not much of a deal. There's not much of a negotiation. It's like, hey, here's what we'll argue the federal sentencing guidelines will be. You know, you can argue for whatever you want. However, there's other cases where there are very spirited negotiations over a long period of time where you actually are getting something in return. But the federal system and state system are very different. You know, someone who's faced a state charge and is familiar with that negotiation, you know, it's like, hey, you know, 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. Federal court is very different. It's a calculation of what the guidelines might be and the ability for you to argue for whatever sentence you want, typically as a defense lawyer. But no promise by the government, hey, you're going to get 2 or 4 or 6. Mm. So it's really open then to the sentencing hearing where the judge, you know, hears all the aggravating and mitigating evidence and reads lengthy briefs by the parties, reads a pre-sentence report, and then you have a hearing, and then finally you determine what your sentence is. So for a federal defendant, it's a little bit more scary because you know what the guidelines are. You know that the government's going to argue you should be in those range of numbers. You know your attorney's going to argue for something far less, but you really have no certainty as to what that number is going to be.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That must be a scary point to do. But so is there a point in which a plea can no longer happen, or can it happen till the verdict?
Oh, it can happen at any time. Yeah. So you'll have cases that sometimes you could get a plea during the middle of a trial. That can happen, much to the chagrin of the jurors who've sat through the case. But typically it happens before. You hit upon a great point, John. We started a trial in federal court about a week ago last Monday, and we did not have a plea agreement. We had some negotiations. We had a draft plea, never reached an agreement on that. We started jury selection for about 3-4 hours on the first day. And ultimately in the afternoon of the first day of jury selection, we had a plea agreement. So sometimes it's really the defendant seeing the reality of what a trial is and that influencing their decision.
630 wants to know, will we be talking about the Hunter Biden case? I don't know if you're up to speed on the tax charges he's been charged with.
Yeah, I know a bit about it. And if the listener would like to talk any specifics, let's do it. But as your listeners probably know, and you and I talked about many months ago on one of these episodes, I think Biden and his attorneys made a gross miscalculation. They were close to a deal themselves.
On the gun charge and stuff.
I think, you know, it was kind of an overreach by them in terms of what they wanted to get out of the deal.
They wanted immunity from future stuff related to anything, which didn't seem to relate to the charges.
Correct, yeah. And I think the prosecution at that point in time had poorly presented it to the judge and did not have public support, which was a huge factor. So because that deal fell apart, then, you know, the special prosecutor was able to go ahead in the state of California in federal court and charge him with a number of things, mostly relating to the tax issues, which is kind of funny because, you know, he has made full restitution. And we always talk
about... Oh, he's paid up by now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So they're charging him for stuff that happened while they were waiting to get him to charge up.
Well, yeah, but...
Well, there's like salacious details about what he was spending his money on instead of the taxes.
Correct, yeah. So, you know, the money has been paid, but that doesn't matter. The offense doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, we've often talked on your show about whether someone gets better or less better treatment because of their notoriety. In this case, Biden is probably getting a worse situation for himself because of his notoriety, because there's so much public pressure that he should be charged and that a deal shouldn't be cut. But ultimately, there's probably going to be a plea deal that arises out
you
of these
so?
New charges. Yeah, because the tax charges, you know, may not be defensible. We'll see. I don't know what the evidence is, but clearly a deal could arise out of these new charges.
I got a lot of things in my head about the Hunter Biden thing. I do think that if his name wasn't Hunter Biden, I don't know if he'd be charged for any of these things. That doesn't mean that he shouldn't be. And if he broke the law, you can make the argument, yeah, okay, well then you go to trial for that or you plea out, whatever. That's fine by me. Where I think, you know, we got to take our political hats off is on the idea of the original plea, which was, you know, to a gun charge and I think a tax charge as well.
Correct.
To then get immunity from any other possible thing relating to what was happening in Ukraine. Even if you are like the most bleeding heart liberal Democrat, That seemed really strange.
Correct. And I think if I was his defense lawyers at that stage, I would have taken the deal, even if I didn't get immunity from the Ukraine matters, because that was an overreach anyways. That probably was never going to be approved by the judge. Didn't have public support, which put a lot of pressure on the prosecutors. I would have taken my medicine and pled to one of them was going to be a misdemeanor. And likely in that case, if that plea had gone forward, he would have gotten no jail time or a very minimal sentence.
Right.
And people, tax cases, they are charged with some regularity, but usually they're giant sums of money at issue. Right. And the gun charge was really, something that was unusual in that they're alleging that at the time he got the gun, he was someone who was a drug addict and should have disclosed that.
Right. Plus that plea or that settlement, the plea
agreement,
was just left so much to be suspect. If you're trying to make it look as clean as possible, that someone is treated the exact same as anyone else in those circumstances, to offer immunity to what is happening in the other...
It's something else.
Crazy.
Yeah, I agree with you.
All right, we're going to take a break. Then we got the news. Who are we going to be talking with afterwards? Judge Larry Axelrod, huh?
Yes. A former very fine judge, now an arbitrator, and most importantly for purposes of our show today, I think, a great author as well. A legal fiction author.
Way to tease it. Good job, Mike Leonard.
Yeah, thank you.
You're close to having my job.
Should I use the radio voice for that?
No, let's go ahead and pass on that. Okay. More Let's Get Legal. And then the news. Mike Leonard today was like, you know who I want to do? I want to bring on someone. I want to bring on a judge. Mike, what inspired you to bring on our next guest?
Well, Larry, first of all, is a great guy, and I think he's had a really great career on the bench and now off the bench as well. But more fascinating, he's also a writer, and he recently came out with a new book. He's written several, and I just happened to become aware of it only recently. It came out in the fall, but I just learned about it very recently. So he was on my brain to get on the show. And I think everyone's going to enjoy hearing from him.
Judge Larry Axelrod from Circuit Court of Cook County for 14 years. Judge, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah, a little bit over 14 years as a judge.
Oh, that's right. Hold on one second. Iridian, can you help Mike get on his headphones here? He forgot that he can't hear the judge unless he gets his headphones on and turns the volume up. So, Judge, now you can say anything bad you want to say about Mike Leonard because he can't hear you right now.
I can't think of anything bad to say about Mike Leonard. He's a great guy and a phenomenal trial lawyer.
All right. So now you are an arbitrator. Can you explain just really quickly what that job's all about?
I do mediations and arbitrations. A mediation is where the parties come and you negotiate to come to a conclusion, a consensual agreement. And an arbitration is like a trial without a jury, where they present the evidence and the arbitrator makes a decision as to which party should prevail, and if the plaintiff prevails, what the appropriate remedy would be. In other words, how much damages they receive.
And when did you decide to start writing, too?
I began writing in the 80s when I was a young state's attorney, and I would see all these things day after day that were just unimaginable for a kid that grew up in Evanston. And I wasn't very good, so it took me a long time, but I was persistent. And my first book was published in 2000, and there were three books in a row. And then there was about a 16, 18-year gap between the third book and now this fourth book, which is called Stealing Justice.
Awesome. Mike, I know you got some follow-ups.
Yeah, Larry, could you tell the listeners about your career as a prosecutor a little bit more about that?
Sure. I was a prosecutor from 1985 to late 1989, and I went through all the places that you go, and I ended up in the felony trial division at 26th in California. And then I left there because a friend of mine had a practice, and he needed me to come in and take over his practice because he was going on the bench. And that person was Jim Lynn, and Jim Lynn was the judge for Jussie Smollett, and he just retired. So that's kind of like a full circle. And I was a law clerk at 26th in California when I met Jim Lynn, who was a prosecutor and then went on to become a defense attorney, and then he became a judge, and I followed suit.
And in a private practice, did you do any criminal defense, or was it all civil side?
I did criminal defense. I did state and federal work. I enjoyed some of it, but I did, and then I became. I was a lawyer in total for 20 years before I became a judge. So if you're doing the math, before I started, I had 5 years of an arbitrator. So I'm coming up on 39 years of practice as a lawyer or a judge.
Well, what's your favorite role that you've played?
Every one of them was just a thrill. I'm one of those very strange people who's loved their work, and I continue to love my work. I work more today than I've ever worked, and I feel just grateful and lucky to be able to do something that I really enjoy.
And you have a daughter in the law who's now a lawyer, and I have four kids, and only one of them seems to have the interest in going that way. Was she interested the whole time along, or did you encourage that or try to keep neutral on that? How did that come about?
Well, I never encouraged it, and I have two children, and now my son is a lawyer as well. And I had suspicions that my son might be interested, and he works for the Office of the State Appellate Defender. So he's writing briefs on behalf of people that have been convicted. And my daughter is doing medical malpractice defense at a firm. And my daughter going and becoming a lawyer was absolutely unimaginable to me. I thought she aspired to be a Kardashian.
Are we going to cut that from the program, or is she going to hear that as well?
that's live, Mike. We're on.
I don't think she'll hear it because she doesn't have a lot of interest in me.
But. I got to ask Larry, or excuse me, Judge Axelrod. You can call him Larry, Mike. Larry. I cannot.
He makes me call him Judge. So let's be honest.
So when you were writing, books in the 80s, or when you were writing in the 80s, what eventually became a book in the 2000s. Like, are there certain rules about, like, using pen names, even though you were an attorney? Like, is there like, a line that you shouldn't cross? Like, how do you navigate that world of taking the experiences you saw and then putting it into fiction so that it doesn't cross any of those lines?
Well, it's funny because my current book, Stealing Justice, is about a corrupt prosecutor and a couple of crooked lawyers that are fixing murder cases to claim millions of taxpayer dollars. And so it's relevant to what is going on in the world today. But anyone who thinks that I'm writing about them is wrong. none of the characters are related to any people. One of the characters in my book is inspired by someone, but it's a person I've never met. And it's a woman that played semi-pro football for the Chicago Force, which was a women's semi-pro football team in Chicago. And I never met her, but my friend who owns a bar, they would come in afterwards, and he was awestruck by the strength of this woman's personality. And just on what he told me, he inspired me to write that character. So I never met her.
Oh, cool.
But I don't even know her name. But I don't know her true name. I know her nickname. But that was an inspiration. And other than that, a lot of the people in the characters in the book are sort of,
composites of multiple people you've met.
Composites of different people. Yeah. So and things that inspire me that I see, I don't know many people that can carry a character completely by themselves, so I take bits and pieces of people, so I'm not worried about that. And I wasn't smart enough to come up with a pen name.
So. And do you draw any inspiration from the John Grisham type of books, or who would you say you're most closely aligned to in terms of your style or influences?
Well, there was a writer who's passed away that was my inspiration. Robert Parker wrote the Spencer series, and a lawyer at 26 in California, she was a prosecutor, I was a law clerk. She had finished a book, a Robert Parker book, and she said, "Here, you might like this." And I ended up reading everything that he wrote in the Spencer series. I didn't read any of the books written by someone else after he died in that series, but I've read every one of the Spencer books, and there's probably 40, 45, books that he wrote. And what was inspiring was it was so accessible, and the characters were very real. And what I liked about his books was everything didn't end up perfectly. Some things weren't resolved at all at the end of the book. And I thought,
it wasn't all tied down with a bow. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so I liked that. And he kind of inspired me. So that's how I started writing. I began writing in the late 80s, went through a lot of different things. And then I tried to sell a book. And back then, there was no email. You would send a query letter, and they'd send something back. They'd invite you to send them something. They'd read it. They'd send it back. So it was a very demeaning process, but I got a rejection letter from a publisher that was 7 pages long, and he told me all the reasons why, in spite of the fact that he really enjoyed the book, he wasn't going to publish
it. Oh, interesting.
And then I'm sorry?
I said, that's interesting. Keep going.
It was. It was very interesting, but he liked my style, and he liked, but he didn't do this book for reasons that 10 years later he would have done the book, but he gave me... at the end of the note, he said, if you write something else, send it to me at this address and write this on the outside of the package. Don't go through the query process. Send it directly to me at this address with this written on the outside. And I did. And one day I'm sitting in my office in the Monadnock building, and the receptionist says, you have a call from this person. And I thought, you know, surely it's some of my friends, you know, goofing on me. But then I realized that nobody knew who this person's name was. So I picked up the phone and he said, Larry, this is Ron Pitkin, and I read it. I love it. Let's do it.
Nice. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Hey, Larry, Judge Axelrod, we're out of time today. I hope you come back on again soon. We'll have you on. And the book is called Stealing Justice. Where can people find it?
On Amazon is the best place to get it. Stealing Justice by Larry Axelrod on Amazon.com, and thank you for having me.
Larry, we appreciate it. Nice stuff, Mike.
Thanks, Larry. Nice talking to you.
Good guess, Mike Leonard. All right, we'll take a break, and then we have a happy ending to a story that started here, and someone was begging for Mike Leonard's help. It was a sad story about a missing body. It's been found. We'll have the whole update after this on WGN. All right, it's Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Julie Gumina, SDG Law, will be in the 2 o'clock hour. Mike Leonard, we got a couple more minutes here. And a couple weeks ago, we got a call from Rhonda. And tell us what she was wondering about, Mike.
Yeah, so she called the show on one of those days where we were kind of doing a free-for-all.
Yeah.
Like, hey, let's give you legal advice. And, you know, we were just kind of going from the seat of our pants, which is a lot like my practice job,
right.
You know, quite frankly.
Right.
But in any event, Rhonda called, and the situation was that their beloved uncle, who died, he had a contract before he died because he wanted his body to be used for scientific purposes.
Very great.
So something, of course, I knew nothing about. But what you do is you enter a contract, and you do it through an association that's kind of a clearinghouse in Illinois for this. And I assume every state must have something like this. And then the body goes to typically like a university.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, it went somewhere downstate, but they didn't know that. They didn't know where it had been sent. But the problem was, after a certain period of time under the contract and under your agreement, you know, they're supposed to then return the body to you in a cremated form, and you get the body back because that's important to people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what had happened in Rhonda's situation was that for a period of 6 months or more, they were kind of getting the runaround from the association, not giving them the body back, you know, which is very disturbing.
Yeah.
You have a loved one and you want the remains back. It's meaningful to you. And they felt like they were getting the runaround. So we talked to her on the air, had some ideas about what we might be able to do or not do, and then talked to her off the air. And we did our best Dave Savini investigative reporter work. But I sent to the association what we would call a demand letter, basically laying out the facts, citing the fact that there's a contract, and also saying that, you know, we think we might even have a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress under Illinois law.
Wow, you brought the big guns in that letter.
You got to bring the guns, John.
Yep.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And then sometimes you actually have to sue, right? So we were hoping we wouldn't have to bring a lawsuit to get conclusion. But luckily, we sent the demand letter within a relatively short time. We were able to talk to the association.
They because Rhonda had tried calling.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
Yeah. I got to say, once we got them demand letter and started talking to them, they were very receptive at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't say it's all because of the letter, but certainly they were very responsive, very respectful of Rhonda and her family. They then, you know, got the body back from the university where it was. And then Rhonda, and I'm not sure if it's her sister or her aunt, they went there together. And they just had to fill out some paperwork and things, and they told me a kind of a full tour of the premises.
Okay.
And
they got the star treatment. That letter really did some things.
And then that was interesting to me. I'm not sure if I'd want to see all that.
Yeah.
But you know, also a concern was, you know, gee, do you really get the right body back? That was my concern as a cynical, skeptical lawyer.
Right. They're like, oh, they wrote this letter. We don't have it. Uh-oh.
But interestingly enough, there's a very defined process to track the body electronically, you know, electronic wrist bracelet, all sorts of stuff. So you have very high level of confidence that your loved one is the person you're getting back. And to make the story even better, after they did that, they got the remains back. According to Rhonda, they then celebrated, I believe, at Ditka's.
Oh,
they
nice.
Brought their uncle there. And they were treated like stars, and even given, I think, a free glass of wine to in honor of the uncle. So they were. It was a nice ending to a story that you know could have gone the wrong way.
Mike, I appreciate you helping out one of our listeners. That means a lot.
Sure, John. You know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's fun to try, isn't it?
That's not your normal thing. Was that part of what interests you about this? Like, huh, I've never heard of this before. I want to use my lawyerly brain and see what I can do.
Yeah, because, I mean, on the one hand, I know nothing about the law concerning dead bodies and all that sort of stuff. But really, it was a simple dispute in the sense that it was a contractual dispute. And we also maybe had other legal claims. And if we needed to do it, we would have filed the lawsuit to see if we could get the body back. I'm glad we didn't have to do that. But I didn't need to know ultimately a lot about that area of law to intervene. Sometimes you do and you just can't get involved because you don't know what you're doing and you might really do a disservice to the client.
I'm glad you didn't go to trial because I know you were going to send me the invoices for it, not Rhonda. It was going to be me paying for this.
Exactly. I mean, you always get a cut. You didn't tell Judge Axelrod that you're taking, what, a 3% residual on all the Amazon sales for today?
When you joke about that, people are now going to text in. They're going to call in and they're going to say that.
Larry in the audience, we're just joking. Yes. John's not taking a cut.
I am not.
So go to Amazon and still order Stealing Justice.
Buy it or not. All right, Mike Leonard. Where can people reach you at, my friend?
312-380-6559 if you're dealing with any federal or criminal charges or investigations, or if you're a whistleblower.
I love that. Mike Leonard, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Awesome.
For our new tradition, the 23rd of December, Let's Get Legal, we'll have Mike Leonard and Patrick Dolan. We will do the Trial of the Grinch live on the air, where we play back his alleged crimes in Whoville, and Mike Leonard is the defense attorney.
Dolan's got to be the prosecutor.
Now, Dolan's the prosecutor. I'm the judge.
Can we have listeners call in and vote guilty, not guilty?
Please. That's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
I'm going to steal that on the 23rd.
All right.
Jury will be the verdict. We'll talk then, okay?
Thanks, John.